You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
I'm joined now by Simon Nelson, CEO of FutureLearn, the UK's massive open online course platform, which has been offering courses now, Simon, for 12 months. That's why we're talking. It's the anniversary of the first courses on FutureLearn. How's the first year been from your perspective?
It's been absolutely fantastic, yeah. It's surpassed all my hopes and expectations, and we've been seeing some fantastic results. I think our partners are all delighted with the progress we've made as well. The platform seems to have held up really nicely. We've learned a lot along the way. We've still got a hell of a lot more to learn, but we feel that we're really onto something.
You say the platform's held up nicely. I know one of the things we've written about is the speed of development of FutureLearn. Obviously, the American sort of pioneers, if you like, the Coursera's, the edX's, the Udacity's had a bit of a head start on you. And I know a few people, including myself, have written to say, you know, has FutureLearn been quick enough in sort of developing its product? I mean, the last time I looked, it was still in beta. It wasn't even the final product. And this is 12 months on. I mean, have you got anything to say on the speed that FutureLearn sort of moved?
Sure. Well, you know, I still think we've gone at quite some pace, certainly for a startup that's come out of the university sector. I mean, the first I ever heard of the word MOOC was still not 2 years ago. We built and launched a platform in 9 months. We've now run well over 100 courses on that platform. We've got 650,000 people signed up in just a year to nearly 1.5 million courses. So that's some pace. But as I also say to my team, I'm not interested in being first. I'm interested in being best. And our focus on quality means that we don't rush things out. We don't just tag on commoditized bits of technology when we can. We focus on creating a fantastic experience for the learner and on delivering powerful and effective learning outcomes. And if that means sometimes that we'll go at a more measured pace, then I'll always take that for the quality of the output at the end.
And as for beta, is the end of the beta era on the horizon?
Yep, the end of the beta era is here. So we actually think our first anniversary is a good moment to remove that tag. We've made continuous improvements to the platform. As I say, we've learnt a lot through this year. We've implemented what we've learned. We've listened to both our partners and our learners. And we've improved key aspects of the experience, and we now feel, you know, ready and proud to announce version one of FutureLearn. And we deliberately call it version one because, you know, development doesn't stop for a day. Development continues, learning continues, and this will continue to develop as a powerful entry to this market.
I mean, it needs to develop a little bit, doesn't it? I guess if you look at some of the figures, I know we had a piece on the first 20 or so MOOCs and their sort of participation rates. It's a question that always rears its head when you talk about MOOCs. For your platform, not bad figures by MOOC standards. 13% of those who signed up in those courses fully participated. But I mean, you describe it as a fantastic experience for the user. If I was a chef, I mean, I wouldn't be very happy if 1 out of 10 people finished the meal that I'd prepared. You know, that wouldn't suggest an excellent user experience to me.
So the first thing is, I mean, the figure is right, but we actually prefer to look at people who start our courses rather than people who sign up. So when we measure against that, it's more like a quarter, closer to a quarter of people who actually start our courses fully participate in them. And that can vary wildly between courses. So on some courses, we've just had our first course, which has had over 50% of people start it, fully participate in it. And, you know, you compare it to a chef in a restaurant. I don't think that's, you know, that we can all come up with various comparisons. I often like to compare it to TV industry where I worked before and how many people actually watch a whole episode of a program, how many people watch every episode of a series, even of popular series like Doctor Who, never mind factual series running over 6 weeks. And actually, you know, I think for individual products on the web, to try to retain an audience on the most competitive medium there has ever been, for 6 weeks, for 8 weeks, for 10 weeks in some instances, is actually quite an achievement and quite a testimony both to the quality of the courses our partners have created and the features we've put in the platform to encourage people to come back and learn with the same cohort of learners through that period. So we're absolutely delighted with those figures. We can see that on, you know, different courses, different things come into play. So sometimes we put, you know, quite significant barriers in front of people before which they have to overcome if they're going to fully participate in the course. And we recognize that. But what's right for one course is different for another course. And we're seeing some amazing figures and some really high quality courses. And, you know, you can look at the bare participation figures. You can also look at the satisfaction figures, which show that nearly 90% of people rate the courses good or excellent. Nearly everyone would recommend them to a friend. But my challenge to anyone who questions, you know, MOOCs or what we're doing is just go and have a look. Have a look at any course. Have a look at the comments on any step in that course. And I pretty much guarantee you, you'll find a very passionate, erudite audience who are loving the experience they're getting. And more than anything, that shows me that even at this early stage, we're really onto something.
I mean, people are questioning MOOCs, aren't they? I know on our own pages, Diana Laureard of the Institute of Education has questioned them. Sebastian Thrun, perhaps most notably, who started Udacity, one of the big MOOC platforms also involved with Google Glass, a bit of an edtech pioneer all around, came out and said he felt that they had a lousy product. Most people can't stand the name, certainly, apart from anything else. But what's your take on the sort of longevity of these MOOCs? Are they on the wane, do you think, rather than the rise?
I'm not a huge fan of the word MOOC myself. We prefer to see ourselves as a social learning platform. But there's no doubt that there has been this debate. But I always regard it as really the early evangelists of MOOCs, I think, overstated the case for what they could be. And I think there's a degree to which they're being hoisted by their own petard. Sebastian Thrun being one example. So MOOCs were claimed to be pretty much a panacea for many of the educational ills of society when they first came out. I mean, you will have seen, Chris, we've all seen some of the commentary that came around, particularly in 2012, around what MOOCs were going to do. They were going to transform education. They were going to destroy the university system. They were going to put educators out of business. They were going to reach into the most distant parts of the world and educate people who'd never had access to this technology before. Now, all of that, I'm afraid, was overhyped and unrealistic for actually what was happening here. And as a result, I think there's been an entrenchment from people on the other side of the argument, but who, to me, often make almost equally wild assumptions. Mm-hmm. So that these things are a fad, they're going to disappear. Or in the case of Sebastian, as you point out, that his is a lousy product. We certainly don't look at our products and think we've got a lousy product. So I think what we believe in is a more balanced view. We don't believe it's MOOCs that's going to transform higher education, but we do believe the internet's going to transform higher education, and MOOCs are one part of that overall transformation. It's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take many years. It's not going to destroy everything that went before, particularly because many of the incumbents are going to embrace the challenges and opportunities and, in my view, come out stronger. And that's one of the reasons we've launched FutureLearn, to work with our partners to help prepare them for the inevitable challenges, but also the amazing opportunities that the internet brings to transform the way they market to, recruit, and teach their learners.
Let's take a look at some of the partners that you're working with. And initially, it was sort of a game of the top performers in the UK. I know you looked at a number of league tables, university rankings, I believe including the Times Higher rankings, to choose the universities that you wanted to partner with initially. Now, is that the best way to go about choosing the people you work with? There must be some very, very excellent practice in online education among universities that perhaps don't score highly. We know Edge Hill, for example, wanted to do a MOOC on FutureLearn, couldn't. I was at an event with you earlier this year, I think, where someone from the Institute of Education said that they wanted to do a MOOC with FutureLearn, but couldn't get through the door. I mean, are you sort of changing the way you look at how you recruit partners? Are you going to stick sort of to that league table top performers methodology?
The key for us when we got started was to create a group of high quality partners who would create the best quality courses. The instructions to me from my 100% shareholder and my chairman, who's a vice chancellor of the Open University, that shareholder, was to focus on quality, not quantity. That we felt there was an opportunity to take the expertise of the Open University and power a broader partnership of universities to actually bring something fresh and different but have high quality into this market. So we had to focus on a few partners to begin with, and we did have the challenge of where do you draw the line? And key for me was, because I'm brand new to higher education, I didn't want to be making some subjective decision on which universities could join. So we did use ranking systems as the only objective measure out there, one that's unquestionably flawed and not perfect, but one that is at least recognised by all of the players in the market. So that's where we started. And you know what we've learned as we've gone along is that one of the things our partners love about FutureLearn is the amount of support and guidance we give them. Level of collaboration within the partnership, the level of data sharing, which helps to raise all the boats in terms of quality and make sure that any courses that are coming up next are learning from the courses that have gone before. Now that means we can't just open up our doors to anyone because we couldn't provide that level of service, we couldn't guarantee that level of quality in the courses we're providing. However, we're constantly looking at what are the best ways to ensure that broadest range of quality and to support a wider range of universities. So, for example, you know, we did take the decision about 6 months in that we had to open up to international universities if we were going to play on a global stage, if we were going to have credibility for international audiences. And so we've now added 10 very high quality institutions from China, from Korea, from across Europe, from Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and we'll continue to do that as well. But it is constantly finding this balance between scale, and we do want scale because we want more great courses, but maintaining that quality level. So ranking systems have been, you know, a useful tool for us. But whether they're an exclusive tool in the future, I don't know.
So if a lower-ranked university now has a cracking product and an online course that it wants to pitch to FutureLearn, your door's open?
My door's always been open. I'm always ready to talk about great ideas. And, yeah, I'm definitely willing to talk to people.
What about business partners? I mean, we spoke about Sebastian Thrun earlier. Udacity's moved very much towards, I don't know, one way to term it would be, I guess, professional training, CPD, stuff that you can sell to businesses. In order, well, basically to get some money back. I mean, it looks like FutureLearn's sort of doing that too, to an extent. You've tied up with BT. Recently, there was a Marks and Spencer's MOOC, which I know is free to do, and it's with the University of Leeds, but it seemed very much targeted at businesses rather than at your sort of your sort of more general student. Are you moving into that sort of section of the market more? And if so, is that to sort of try and drive revenues?
Well, we're having a look at it, and we're constantly being approached by businesses, major businesses, who are interested in our platform, interested in the concept of social learning to try to drive transformation in their training and development. And as with all other aspects of education, training and development is unquestionably ripe for transformation as new tools and technologies come along. The key for us is, you know, less than 2 years old as a company, less than 1 year since we launched our first courses. We have to keep focus. And we're wary of being pulled too far towards some of the B2B opportunities, business-to-business opportunities we know are there. We're most interested at the moment in building our learner base internationally and growing learners all over the world. And so we're trying to find the right balance between exploring and investigating some of those business opportunities, but also creating a very powerful portfolio of open courses that can attract large audiences all over the world. Now, those two strategies are not actually incompatible. So clearly, one of the things that will most attract a learner is the idea that a course they do will equip them with skills to help them develop professionally. And in terms of providing credibility for those courses, well, the presence of a major employer like Marks and Spencer's, the presence of, in our first ever course, our course on branding, the presence of a world-class branding organization actually helping to teach that course, these really lend a huge amount of credibility. So we're actually working with businesses on a number of levels, both to sponsor, co-create, contribute to, and recognize our courses.
When you say sponsor, I mean, are they're putting cash in, presumably?
In some cases.
I mean, how much, for example, would BT have paid to sponsor?
We're not going to be specific on individual deals between individual companies, but there are financial investments possible. There are content investments possible. So opening up access to expertise within their organization, opening up access to their own content, for example. There are a whole range of ways that we can work, not only with major employers, but it's also part of the way in which we work with major content owners, different corporate, different cultural bodies. So as you know, we are also partnered with the British Library, British Council, British Museum, and on Monday, the 13th, we've actually, 13th of October, mm-hmm. we've actually got our first course launching with the BBC. Actually, there's a whole range of partnerships, and one of the great things we see about what we're doing is that ability to bridge the education sector with a whole range of new partnerships, whether in the business, corporate, cultural, content sectors.
Mm. Sticking with income, I mean, you've been very fortunate to have been set up as a startup by the Open University. I guess that guaranteed you a certain amount of investment at the very beginning. But whenever asked about sort of where the money comes back to FutureLearn, one of the two sort of strands is the sale of certificates and accreditation, the other being examinations. You have both of those in your portfolio. I think it's called a statement of attainment, and it costs, is it in the region of £50, something like that?
So what we've got is a statement of participation that's eligible to anyone who completes more than 50% of the steps in the course and all of the assessments. That costs £24.
Okay.
And then on fewer courses, we've been experimenting with offering examinations at the end of the course. Those examinations take place in a test centre, physical test centre provided by a partner. We have those test centres all over the world. That costs about £120.
Mm-hmm. So how many people have taken you up on the certificate, and how many people have taken you up on a £120 exam?
So we're not yet public on the specific figures. What I will say is that take-up has considerably exceeded our business model projections at this stage.
So why not tell us?
Because we're just not ready to yet, and we'll bring this information out at some point. But I'm extremely encouraged by it, quite excited by it. I'm excited by the spread of courses that people are buying these statements on. So we have a portfolio of healthcare courses, often quite niche, in areas like medicines adherence or swallowing difficulties. We have a course on dental photography. Actually, the percentage of people who are eligible who are buying these courses has staggered us. Buying these statements has staggered us. But even on courses such as England in the Time of Richard III, one of our most popular courses, or Shakespeare in His World, courses that you wouldn't traditionally put into that professional development area, then actually we're seeing very large numbers of statements sold there as well. Mm. And there's a variety of motivations. But generally, people are getting to the end of these courses. They have had a fantastic experience. I can't repeat that enough. You know, go and check these courses and see what people are saying about them, because they are loving them. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the course, some people are buying those statements as part of their CPD, continuous professional development. Some people, for a personal reward, motivation, souvenir of a fantastic experience they've done. And we've actually got some learners who've bought multiple certificates, and it's lovely because they post themselves on Instagram and on Twitter and share these around. And you can go and have a look at the stories of some of our learners on our blog, and there's some quite inspiring things in there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've been very excited by the initial commercial indications that we're seeing. But, you know, our first full year of business was always one with modest commercial aspirations. Things start to heat up now. And, you know, so we're hoping to ramp up both the number of courses that are offering these types of services, the range of commercial products we offer. So as well
what,
as offer,
what can we expect? Yeah, sorry, go ahead. What can we expect?
Well as offering certificates at the end of the course, we'd like to offer the ability to buy into some sort of verified or authenticated statement at the beginning of a course. So one that helps to track who you are.
So similar to Coursera's Signature Track?
We're definitely learning from what Coursera are doing with Signature Track. They seem to have been very successful with it. What they're also seeing is it's actually a powerful motivator for people who start the courses to continue through them. Now, we don't want to copy Coursera. We believe, actually, every month that goes by, I think we're diverging in the approach we take to delivering online learning. We do want to learn from the best, and the best of what's happening out there. So we want to bring a future lens spin to this, one that's based on our own theories and philosophies of social learning, but one that provides greater value to the learner. So expect some innovations in commercial product development there over the next year. You know, my challenge is to break even in an appropriate amount of time that I've agreed with the Open University, and then start to return a profit to them.
I take it you won't tell me when that time is.
No, I won't tell you that yet. We're on track. And when people sort of compare different players in this emerging market, I do say I think we've got the best of both worlds. We have the dynamism of being a for-profit commercial startup, but we are owned by a not-for-profit university that has a long-term view, that has a broad range of strategic reasons for launching FutureLearn, and I have to say, I had my board meeting earlier this week, is absolutely delighted with progress.
Hmm. My final question, Dan, actually relates to the Open University. Martin Bean obviously was Vice Chancellor there for a good while at the launch of FutureLearn as well. He's no longer at the university. I mean, he was a big driver, wasn't he, of this project. Have you lost a sort of key ally there? And are you, you know, concerned at all that maybe now he's not in post the Open University's approach to how it runs FutureLearn or works with FutureLearn might change?
Well, Martin doesn't actually leave the Open University till the end of the calendar year, so we've still got him for a while yet. And he was very, very present at my board meeting the other day, and I continue to deal with him as my chairman every week. There's no doubt that FutureLearn is very much Martin's initial idea. It was his drive, it was his charisma, it was the trust and respect with which he's held by university vice chancellors that helped us create the amazing set of initial partners that got us started. He's also, as anyone who's worked with him will know, you know, he is quite an inspirational guy. So there's no doubt that I'll miss him personally, although he's only a little way across the water. in Australia, and the time zone isn't going to stop him from retaining some sort of involvement with FutureLearn, I'm sure. So, and as for, you know, what comes next, it isn't only because of Martin that the Open University launched FutureLearn. FutureLearn is a very significant strategic play for the Open University. In my view, a bold and very enlightened move for a player in a market that's being disrupted by the internet. I do think that these moments in an industry's history, based on my own experience from media, across the media, I think that the web rewards collaboration, rewards partnership, and rewards these types of bold moves. Mm. And that strategic decision was not made solely by Martin. That was made by all the senior management at the Open University. And as I say, so far they're delighted with what we're doing. My job is to make sure they stay that way.
And the chair position, when Martin does leave, is it automatically the new VC of the Open University, or does that post become open to others?
We have no precedent whatsoever on it, so we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Simon Nelson, thanks very much for talking to me.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.